80 years ago today, the then Prime Minister, Robert Menzies, declared Australia was at war in what would become the deadliest conflict in human history.
Fellow Australians, it is my melancholy duty to inform you officially that in consequence of a persistence by Germany in her invasion of Poland, Great Britain has declared war upon her, and that as a result, Australia is also at war.
Nearly a million Australians enlisted in World War II. 40,000 were killed. 30,000 were taken as prisoners of war. Among the POWs was Jim Kerr, who was captured by the Japanese army and forced to work on the notorious Thai-Burma Railway. He's 94 years old today. He joins me from our Melbourne studios. Jim Kerr, welcome to breakfast.
Good morning.
You were only 17, I believe, when you were captured by Japanese forces.
Yes, I had my 17th birthday cut off behind the Japanese lines. And yeah, just a boy of 17, Hamish.
What do you remember of your 17th birthday?
I don't remember it because, as I say, behind the Japanese lines for 4 weeks and had no idea what the dates were. So my 17th birthday would have passed by without any recognition whatsoever. There was five other fellows with me and we'd been cut off and we're behind the Japanese line, so the date just went by without me knowing.
You describe yourself as a boy at 17, but in fact you were only 15 years old when you...
When I joined up, yes.
Enlisted. What do you remember about that? Why did you decide to do it?
My life was going to be in the Royal Australian Navy. I was 14 when the war broke out. In peacetime, he joined the Royal Australian Navy at 16 and a half as a boy seaman, and he signed on for 12 years. When the war broke out, the Navy put the age up to 18, and you had to show your birth certificate. I saw a casual friend of mine who was in Army uniform. I asked him how the heck he got into the Army, knowing that he's the same age as me. He said, I put my age up. So I decided that, well, I can't get in the Navy till I'm 18. I'll join the Army. So I managed to persuade my mother and father. And when the recruiting officer asked me my birthday, I said 5th of 2nd, 1920, which meant that I was 20 years of age. So in actual fact, Hamish, according to my Army records, I'll be 100 years of age on my birthday next year, but in actual fact, I'll be 95.
You should be demanding the letter from the Queen.
Yeah, well, yeah, so I've got to wait another 5 years. But if you want to go to my army, it's there in black and white, Hamish. I'll be 100 years of age on the 5th of February 2020.
I suppose it tells us something of the mood of the time that as a 14-year-old boy, you had a conversation with your parents convincing them to let you change your age to go off and fight this war. Do you remember what you told them?
Oh, well, when my father was a First World War digger, been wounded in the trenches, he still had the scar on his forehead where he'd been shot. And naturally, when I said I want to join the army, they just wouldn't have a bar off it to start with, but I kept at them. And in the end, they said, well, you go up the drill hall and they'll laugh you out of the place. But they didn't laugh me out of the place. So I finished up joining the army. And naturally, when my father saw me in my army uniform for the first time, well, he was as proud as punch, of course, even though I was only 15.
How did you fall into the hands of the Japanese?
Well, it's a long story, so I'll shorten that, Hamish, down to we'd been told to withdraw after facing the Japanese for 4 days. And their usual tactics was once they met head-on, a strong head-on resistance, then come around the flanks, encircle you and gradually cut you to pieces. So after 4 days, we were ordered to withdraw. It wasn't a rout, it was an orderly withdrawal. And retreating, I'd been cut off with five other fellows from the 2nd 29th Battalion, a Victorian battalion, and we finished up behind the Japanese lines for 4 weeks wandering around. And our plan was to make for the east coast of Malaysia and steal a boat and make for Sumatra. And when you come to think of it, rather a stupid plan, really, to try and sail a boat over to Sumatra. But that was our plan. We knew that we could make for Singapore because the Japanese were between us and Singapore. So that was our plan until we met this well-educated Indian. He asked what we were doing. We told him. He said, "Did you know that Singapore had fallen?" We said, "No." He said, "It fell 5 days ago. Today is the 20th of February." Well, we had no idea what the date was. So we had a quick talk amongst ourselves, decided we had to give ourselves up, asked whether they were taking prisoners. He said, "I don't know." We decided we'd take the chance. He went in and got the Japanese. So we heard the truck pull up, and we stood up and raised our hands in the air. The Japanese came down towards us with their rifles, of course, and we didn't know whether we were going to be shot on the spot or taken prisoner, but fortunately we were taken prisoner. So we were then taken to a small town. From there we were taken up to Kuala Lumpur, and as we were approaching the Kuala Lumpur proper, we could see these heads on the poles, which were Chinese dissidents who'd been executed, their heads cut off and stuck on poles. So we were put in the main prison there, which was Pudu Prison, that ultimately held 1,000 British troops and about 150 Australians. We were there until October 1942. Then we were taken down to Changi, where we rejoined our units. And, of course, everybody thought we were dead, so much rejoicing when we rejoined our unit. So that's how I was taken prisoner.
As you say, you did spend some time in Changi Prison, but you were eventually sent to Konyu Camp on the Thai-Burma Railway.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
How did you compare those two experiences?
Oh, no comparison. If I hear people speak of Changi as if it was some horrifying experience, but if somebody, knowing what I know now, if somebody had said to me, "Where would you like to spend your 3.5 years in Changi or Thailand?" The 2.5 years I spent in Thailand, including the railway, I would have no hesitation whatsoever in saying, "I'll take Changi, thanks." When I was in Thailand for the 2.5 years, when I was sent up there to work on the railway, I never saw electric light or running water for 2.5 years. In fact, as prisoners of war, what we take for granted today, we never had soap, we never had toothpaste, toilet paper, I never had a towel. I managed to scrounge a blanket from somewhere. And the things that we take as everyday items, we did without those for 3.5 years. And that was part of our lot as POWs. We never had the things that we just take for granted every day, and never sat at a table to eat a meal. We either sat on our bunk or else squatted on the ground. We adopted the native style of squat. We squat down and ate our meal.
We still talk today about soldiers coming to terms with the horrors that they've experienced in war. You're now, as you say, 94. How have you managed that over the course of your lifetime? The memories of mateship, obviously, and friendship, but also the deep despair and the dark horror.
Well, one thing, you bring up mateship, and the Australians are very strong on mateship, Hamish, and that is one thing that we realised very early in the piece, once we'd been taken prisoners. That to survive, you had to have a mate or mates. So you supported one another when you were sick, when you had malaria, which took 4 or 5 days to pass. You certainly never felt like eating your rice, so they would share your rice amongst them. And then when they had malaria, which everybody contacted, of course, in the 3.5 years, we would eat their rice, share their rice. I must bring this up, though. The men that were head and shoulders above all other men on the railway were the medical officers. They were honestly, every morning, like the Japanese would, a quota would be submitted to our people. the Japanese required so many men to go out and work on the railway. If when the fit men lined up, or what we classed as fit men, and we hadn't reached that quota, they would then go into the hospital, and men that could stand, they considered fit enough to go out on the railway. The men who could barely stand, they would sometimes take them out and have them sitting down and breaking up rock, smallish rocks into smaller rocks that are going to be used as ballast. So every morning, the medical officers will be there fighting every morning, 7 days a week, fighting to keep their sick men in the hospital. And I when I was evacuated off the railway to the big hospital camp at Tarso, my ward was next to the ulcer ward. And the stench of the rotting flesh from all these men with ulcers, you couldn't describe it. It was terrible. And the method of treatment was that the orderly would come around each morning, and with a sharpened spoon, he would scrape away the putrid flesh down to the good flesh, and ultimately, if the ulcer didn't heal, which most of them didn't, then the leg would come off. So the screaming of the men waiting for their turn for the sharpened spoon was horrifying.
Jim, I was supposed to have wrapped the interview up by now, but I think we are all so privileged to hear from you. Do you mind giving us a few more minutes?
Thanks, Hamish.
What would you like us all to think about today? 80 years ago, Australia declared its entry into the war. How should we all reflect on this piece of our history?
I think we should reflect on the million people who gave their services to Australia in the Second World War, of whom 40,000 died. We should reflect on those people that did give their lives, and also those who served, who were part of our armed forces. And we must not forget that what we have today is through not only Australians, but the other people who fought in the Allied forces. What we have today is through their sacrifice and what they gave to their countries. And we should not forget that even though we take our freedom for granted today, we move in our society free, no restrictions, nobody standing there with machine guns. And to see the news with what is happening in Hong Kong, they are fighting for what we take for granted, our freedom. And that is the thing, Hamish, freedom. Most of the countries, if you think of the countries that have been oppressed, their freedom has been oppressed. So the thing that I reflect on today is that how grateful we should feel for what has been done, so the people of today, particularly our younger people, the older people, of course, that went through the Second World War, they do have some idea, but the younger people should know that what they have today is not something that has just been granted easily. Freedom, that's the word, Hamish, freedom, and that's what the Hong Kong people are fighting for, freedom.
And when you see leaders around the world today so openly countenance going into conflict, what do you think, given that you've seen the impact of it?
Well, I might be saying the wrong thing here, but I do not like the influence of China, with the way they're extending their influence, and particularly in our universities, they're infiltrating our universities. They're giving some of these Southeast Asian countries loans and also building things for them. So I think of what the Japanese, their idea of extending what they call a co-prosperity Southeast Asian area, the way they extended their tentacles down into Southeast Asia, I sort of feel the same thing is slowly happening again.
Jim Kerr, we appreciate your service. We will think about those messages today, and we're grateful to you for coming on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hamish. Thank you for having me.
Jim Kerr. 94 years old, served for Australia in the Second World War and joined at the age of 15.